Hi, Blogging Heads viewers. This is Daniel Strauss with another episode of Woodruff and Strauss. And today we have not a political writer, but the esteemed former business writer and now feature writer for ESPN Magazine. Or is it ESPN The Magazine?
ESPN The Magazine.
ESPN The Magazine, Mina Kimes. Mina and I are going to go over a few topics, most of which have nothing to do with politics, but I have warned Mina that I might slip a little bit in there, but, you know, we're going to do that. And the first thing we're going to talk about today is Mina's last big piece, which was a piece on Devonta Pollard, a basketball superstar, and what became a complicated relationship with his mother. And in the premise of this, like, it kind of sounded almost Greek. Mina, could you talk about, like, give us a run over of what the story was and all that, pretty much?
So Devonta Pollard is a student at Houston now. He's on the basketball team there. And he sort of made the news last summer when he was charged with conspiracy to commit kidnapping. So the reason he was in the news at all is that when he was in high school, he was a McDonald's All-American. He graduated in 2012. He was one of the top 25 basketball recruits in the country. He was getting calls from all the top programs. He was, as I mentioned, a McDonald's All-American. He was Mr. Mississippi. You know, he was a real rising star. And he ended up going to Alabama his first year. After his freshman year was when the incident happened. So it was the spring of 2013 when his mother was arrested for kidnapping her cousin's daughter, I believe, over a land dispute. And Devonta and a few other relatives were dragged into the whole thing.
Yeah. And the thing about it is that this was that his mother was like, I mean, you hear this in sports sometimes, and it kind of reminded me, I mean, of other instances, actually with Teddy Bridgewater and his family. I think his parents and his mother is like the quarterback for formerly the University of Louisville. There are a few instances, I think, where in sports there's a story about you know, a mother who's incredibly supportive of the son athlete who hits it big and stuff. And that sort of is like the premise here, but this is different. This is more complicated.
I think a lot of, like, you know, a lot of star athletes come from difficult backgrounds more than stars in other fields. And a lot of times, you know, for them to sort of get to where they are, it requires the presence of a really involved parent, often a mother. And it often involves a backstory, I think, that, you know, it has a lot of difficulty. I mean, a lot, just due to sort of class and where they come from. And what became an issue in this story, and is something I kind of get into, is these expectations. Well, do you leave that behind? Do you maintain relationships with these people from your past?
Mm-hmm. Do you think, I mean, do you... Why don't we hear about that more? I mean, does that usually sort of hurt the narrative of these sort of Cinderella stories or these players or these like national stories that we kind of want to believe? We want to eventually find a place where an athlete, you know, rises from these like really tough situations and is saying, you know, you're the real MVP and all that stuff.
You don't hear about, I mean, I think a good example is DeSean Jackson. We did a feature on him. Cord Jefferson wrote a feature on him a couple months ago, maybe. And so he, you know, star wide receiver, he was in the Eagles. And after he was dropped by the team, all this stuff came out about his alleged gang ties and, you know, and these crimes that he had been sort of tangentially involved in. He was never, you know, charged with anything. And he came out in this story and said, you know, yeah, I'm friends with people who are involved in this stuff, but they were my friends coming up. I'm not going to not be friends with them anymore. So just because I personally don't do these things doesn't mean I can cut ties to all of these sort of people I grew up with.
What do you think the reaction was to that? And what do you think the reaction was, I guess, with your story too? As a half African-American, half Caucasian person, I feel like the bigger theme behind the Devonta Pollard story was that there's a lot more complicated to athletes, and there's a lot more, you know, there's no single story of an athlete that was just a good person who was on the court all day, every day. They interacted with real people, and, you know, real people are not black and white, or, you know, they're not all, I mean, it's just hard to live a very simple life, but we all want to believe when they get to this level that they're like, I mean, similar in the way with politicians when they reach the, you know, the federal level or the national level, that there is nothing complicated in their past, and almost to a T, that is never true.
And do you maintain those relationships? You
Yeah.
know, I mean, the thing with his mother was really complicated because she was, as I sort of go into in the piece, his best friend. She was his confidant. You know, he'd been through, before even any of this happened, he'd been through more than most people go through in their lifetime. I mean, his father died when he was a freshman in high school. Their house burned down a couple years after that. I mean, it just crazy. You know, he comes from this tiny town, and his mother was always there. And she was his basketball coach. You know, she was a college basketball player. She was very good. She mentored him. She was at every game. She was always practicing with him, always trying to find the best for him. So, you know, after everything they've been through, she's in prison now in Minnesota. And he, you know, he still talks to her every night. And I think some people find that kind of confusing and hard to understand.
Why do you think that is? I mean, I guess.
We left out, sorry, I left out kind of a key part of the story, which is that so his mother was indicted for kidnapping, and he and several other relatives who were really involved and kind of confused by the whole thing were also charged. They all pled out and received shorter sentences. And Devante, you know, in the end, his mother was given a plea offer to sort of exculpate him from any prison time, which she turned down. So I think that actually, sorry, is probably a key factor of the story here that we're leaving out. In the end, he did testify against her. She went to prison for 25 years. So that's what we're looking at when we're asking, you know, wow, they're still best friends. That's the thing they've been through over the last year, which is crazy. Right. So sorry, if you haven't read the story, that's kind of a key
Don't
part. Yeah.
leave killing the lead here or something. I don't know.
Go read it. But yeah, so despite all of that happening, they are still very much so the best
I
friends.
think, but by the way, one of the most powerful parts to me in the piece was when you described how Devonta got a call from his mother one day and told him to bring, like, was it a wrench or like
Yeah.
tools and to
She was starting the
come.
whole kidnapping.
Right.
Yeah, she was tools, do this. And she his involvement was that she called him, he picked up another relative, brought her as the whole thing was going down, he had no idea.
Right, and he it was a lot like you would do, like I would like to think with one of my best friends, like you would just like he said your friend says bring I don't know like toilet lots of toilet paper and lots of booze, don't ask questions, and I'll just be like okay and just bring the whole
Yeah,
thing.
I don't think he ever thought for a second that, you know. I
So do you think
mean,
this
she didn't.
change do you think like writing this has changed, I mean, I guess, I mean, when stories like this come up, or this one in particular, does that change the view of the athlete? Does that change how announcers during games talk about them? And like,
That's
what
a great
about,
question.
sorry?
No, that's a great question. Yeah, I always wondered that after something comes out. I think with him, so after this all happened and he testified against his mother and he was given a deferred process, he wasn't sent to prison, was not charged, you know. He went back, he dropped out of Alabama and played at a community college in his hometown in Mississippi. And you know, he really wanted a fresh start, kind of regroup, play with his high school friends. But one of the things he told me and that his relatives told me was, you know, the rumors really followed him and he had a tough time that year because if you look up his name on the internet, you know, you find a mugshot and you find these stories that say kidnapping and you don't know that this he wasn't really involved. You just see the word kidnapping and if you're a coach or a fan or an opposing fan, what do you think?
Right.
So I think, you know, getting the full story out was important to him, sort of telling his side and having a comprehensive account of everything that happened, just to sort of clear his name and add that depth, you know, to who he is. And you know he's doing quite well. He's 3 games into the season down at Houston, and he's doing really well, actually.
Does it, I want to tap into your rabid Seattle Seahawks fandom here. Because, I mean, one thing about this discussion also that reminded me of was, you know, Richard Sherman. And, you know, when he got all this scrutiny for this big rant. And I think anytime you Google him, because, you know, as it's been said, the internet is written in permanent ink. So there was a big review of who this guy was after that. He wasn't just the good Seattle Seahawks player. And I don't know who your favorite Seahawks player was. Pretty sure it's someone on the Seahawks, though. But, like, can you, as a fan yourself, can you talk a little bit about, like, when you learn more about an athlete, if that changes your opinion? And I've got, I mean, I've definitely got some thoughts on my favorite baseball player, Jake Peavy.
Right. Yeah, I mean, well, Richard Sherman, the more you learn, the more you like him. I mean, the guy has an amazing backstory. You know, he's incredibly smart and driven. He comes from Compton. His dad drove a garbage truck. He worked his ass off. You know, so there are athletes where you learn these things about them that add shades and color and context that make you like them more. But that doesn't always happen. You know, I can think of so many athletes that I've admired, I guess, and you know, you don't... You do sort of have the kind of cognitive dissonance between worshiping them as a fan and sort of feeling a different way about them because of their off of the field activities. Richard Sherman's an interesting example, though. Oh, sorry.
We're still good. Yeah, you're okay. Still good. It's okay.
He's an interesting example. You know, it was funny at the beginning of the podcast, you were saying this is normally about politics, you know, I'm a sports writer, but he's such a good example about how politics is sports and sports is politics. And I think how more athletes are kind of unafraid to go there and to speak their minds about social and political issues. And he's really been a figurehead for that and continues to be, which is amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Your question, by the way.
Yeah. My question was like, I mean, are there any, can you, yeah. Like well, who's your favorite complex athlete? I'm not going to go into too much detail about this, but I remember being at a Steelers party once, and like I think to this day there will always be at any Steelers gathering a discussion of Ben Roethlisberger. And this was really fascinating to me, because I remember again and again fans would be like, I'm really not a fan of Ben's personal choices, right, or something like that, but I like him on the field. And right. I think there were, you know, I mean, it's an extreme example because it's monstrous, you know, the stuff around this guy. But I gotta say, I think there is a lot of the time when you learn more, when you learn that there are these, you know, multifaceted, multi-sided stories about an athlete and someone you really like, it really does spur some introspection or some desire for acceptance. And I got to tell you, Mina, more so in politics, where it's, you know, there are key votes and comments, and those are just it's a lot harder because the spheres are a little more disconnected.
Right. Yeah. I mean, well, obviously, so many people are going through this with Adrian Peterson, right? Yeah. Probably more so than, you know, Ray Rice or any of the other athletes who've been in the news lately. I mean, you know, I, along with many other fantasy football owners, debated during the period when it looked like Adrian was going to come back, am I going to be the guy who picks up Adrian
Peterson? But, you know, well, were you? Were you?
Yeah, and then I dropped him when it looked like he wasn't. But you know, that's obviously fantasy fandom.
Honesty.
Is a little bit.
No, honesty is good. Yeah, go. Yeah.
It's also more cynical than real fandom because, you know, you're just, it's a competition, whereas for a Vikings fan, it's a little bit of a different calculus.
Right.
But it's challenging, I think. You do have to kind of look inside and think about what you care about and how much you need the people you root for in one sphere to embody things in another.
Yeah. I want to switch gears a little bit and go on to, I have sworn myself that I wouldn't abuse my power as a co-host of this podcast with Betsy Woodruff, who is doing fantasy football but knows nothing about sports otherwise, to highlight, I don't know if I've mentioned because it's only been about 14 minutes since we've been talking, or you noticed my lanyard on me, but I'm a big University of Michigan fan.
Okay.
And there's been a lot going on this week, but before we get to that and the game and all of that, there was a tragic story out of Ohio State where an Ohio State player was found in a garbage can or a dumpster, I think.
Yeah.
After missing for a long time and a gunshot wound to the head. And I think there are more details coming out about him. But why are we, I guess I want to do a really broad question here.
Sure. Yeah.
And get your mind on this. Like, why are we always, I mean, this was a really bad story. This is a really sad story and a tragic story. But why are we always surprised or taken aback? Because, I mean, a lot of really good athletes are African Americans, and a lot of them come from these backgrounds, which, like you said, are hard. Why are we always surprised by this? Why aren't we more aware? Why do you think as fans and as just followers of sports, we are quick to assume that everything is okay until it's not? Or do you think that's not the case?
You mean with the Ohio State player and sort of depression?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, there's certainly a stigma around mental illness in the locker room still, and especially, well, not especially, but certainly on a collegiate level. As you know, I mean, from what I've read, you know, suicide on campus, you know, is a huge problem, or it's more concentrated, I guess, on college campuses and a lot of spheres. And why wouldn't athletes be part of that equation?
You I know, guess it, yeah, I don't know. I think
they also go through the same things that, are you still there? Sorry, it's kind of.
Yeah, I'm still here. You still got me. I'm breaking up a little bit.
But. Okay. Your face froze. Anyways, yeah, I think they're going to look at his brain and check for CT and that's, nope. There we go. We're back. You know, that's sort of the larger question with college athletes right now, especially football. That, you know, coupled with mental illness, whether the two are intertwined, is sort of something that's still being discussed.
I gotta be honest. The thing about that, the only thing I gotta say on that point is that I, someone, it is, I gotta expect that the stigma about mental illness will never, I mean, I think the athletic arena will be the last place where the stigma goes away, because mm-hmm. this is the part, I mean, because it definitely is still, even, and less so than in previous decades or generations, it's definitely viewed still as sort of a weakness, and athletes, by definition, are supposed to be the strongest, the best among us, and they're supposed to be, like, the most capable in some way on this. So,
well, and that's sort of, I mean, all of these issues that are, you know, domestic violence, mental illness, child abuse, violence in general, you know, why, you know, when they happen in professional sports or college sports, it does seem more surprising to some people, or it is sort of magnified on a greater level because these people are, you know, the big, tough athletes. And they're also just people that fans really care about and are interested in. So it does create an opportunity to have discussions about the issues. But I think the surprise factor is still there.
And what about you? Are you ever surprised? Or are you, I mean, as a journalist covering this stuff?
Right. No, I mean, I think with the domestic, to totally change that sort of in a way, with the domestic violence issue, you know, these incidents have always happened. It's just now they're getting out there. It's not like suddenly there's been a random spate of incidents. It's only that there's more accountability, and I think we'll see that across a number of issues in professional sports.
That sounds like a good thing, right? I mean, that's good that it's more, that's getting out of there, right?
Right. I mean, it's like, and again, to totally jump, you know, with what happened to Eric Garner. Yeah, body camera, you know, having a tape on it didn't save his life, and
No.
it didn't, but it means that the tape was out there. And so I think, again, there's just more transparency, there's more accountability going on, and there'll be more criticism.
Yeah. Now I want to switch to the other side of the game, which is the University of Michigan. I don't
Sure.
know if you've heard, but the University
My
of
dad
Michigan.
is a Michigan alum.
Really?
And I
He
lived
is?
as a child, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
And you're rooting for any other football team, but, well, it's not hard. I don't know if you've heard, Amina, maybe your dad has mentioned it once or twice, but the University of Michigan athletic department is not doing so hot right now.
No, he's kind of fallen up. Stop paying attention.
That's, you know, my dad is really into the Chicago White Sox, and I begged him to take a break for a year because they're so bad. And he, like, I mean, it's like a switch. You turn it on with him, and he's watching every game, and it's just painful.
Yeah.
So the New York Times recently wrote a story about the various problems with the University of Michigan football team. And not so long ago, I think in the last 48 hours, because kind of news is kind of a blur to me, we fired our coach, Brady Hoke, and
Right.
we are coachless. And this came a little while after we fired our athletic director. And by the end of Brady Hoke's term at Michigan, which was only about 4 years or so, everyone was ready to, there were protests. There was a march on the school president's house. If I read tomorrow that there were literally torches and pitchforks somewhere on the campus of the University of Michigan, I wouldn't be surprised. Basically, the big knocks on Brady Hoke were that he didn't win very many games. There was an incident where our backup quarterback, who had already been injured, was sent out back on the field and stumbled and very clearly was in danger of having a concussion. And then meanwhile, our athletic director, Dave Brandon, his strategy for Michigan was to just monetize everything and just sort of make it just like make a weird system of, like kitschy jerseys for every game, matchups that people didn't really want, like against Appalachian State. And so finally that's over. And it's kind of sad because on my Facebook feed, a lot of my friends and fans would be like, you know, Brady Hoke is a Michigan man, but he's got to go. And that's where we're at. I guess my personal frustration as a fan is that the University of Michigan has all these weird sort of traditions and rules, and they're very stuck to this. I don't know if you've better ever been to a school that where tradition is like a big thing or something. Okay. Yeah. Well, you know, yeah, maybe a few.
Not athletic.
Right. Wait, did you guys win the Harvard Yale game this year?
I think no.
Okay.
But honestly, I have never watched.
Okay. Really? Wow. You're a bad Yale fan.
I just care.
Confessions of Mina Kimes on here.
Yeah.
All right. My sister went to Harvard, but I don't really know either. And
I think Harvard won.
Okay.
Well, let me ask you something on Michigan. Sorry.
Yeah.
I mean, which I've been wondering. So ticket sales are way down, right? And I think this year, for the first time ever, they came close to not selling more than 100,000 a game, you know, in the Big House. As a kid, I went to some of the games during the boat, you know. Do you think that is... What percentage of that is the performance of the team, and what percentage of that is this increased atmosphere of commercialism that you were referring to, that sort of Dave Brandon walk brought
I think,
in?
I mean, it's...
You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, it's a little bit of the grumbling, but, like, the University of Michigan is the rich school in the state of Michigan, which I guess may not be saying too much, but, like, these are... If the money's there, if the winning is there. And the thing is about Michigan...
But the winning drives everything.
The winning drives everything. The thing is about Michigan is that the attitude is always, we need to hire someone from who understands Michigan, who has a background in Michigan, who's been there before.
That just means winning.
Right, right, exactly. That's
like
that's complete
at every school,
bullshit,
you know?
To me. And it's right. Like, it's like, so we won't hire... Like, theoretically, whoever we hire next as a coach has to have some background in Michigan. It couldn't be just, like, a winner. It couldn't be, I mean, both Jim and John Harbaugh have been mentioned a lot, but it couldn't be, I don't know, like, okay, Lovie Smith is not that good, but
Someone from
someone,
the SEC or something.
yeah, it couldn't
Florida.
be, yeah, right. It couldn't be, I don't, Dan Mullen has been mentioned from Mississippi State. I don't think it's going to be him because, as I understand it, he doesn't have a big Michigan thing. But, as I scowled all through college, what all these kids mean is winning. All they really want is winning. It's an insane rule.
So all this kind of the talk of the Michigan man, this anti-commercialism is sort of all an excuse in a way, or at least a bit of a cover for
Right.
the real problem, which is that they're not good.
Right. There was talk, Nicole Auerbach, who's a sports writer for USA Today, tweeted out that the new president of the university, said that he wants, or someone, no, sorry, I think it's Jim Hackett, the interim athletic director, said that there would be a push to get rid of the phrase Michigan man, which is kind of a derogatory phrase, but it's also one that's used kind of with pride. It's kind of like, it's not like the N-word, but it's a word that we've made ours, and it's sort of
Right,
someone who's
kind of a
up,
corny, but
yeah, something like that.
sure.
Like, it's not fetch. I don't know. I don't know what the kids are
It's a
saying.
little
It's,
cheesy.
yeah.
Yeah.
And the idea is that, we're getting rid of some of these really ridiculous traditions that are holding us back. I'm hoping so. I don't know where you land on this, and I know there's a big debate in actually the political commentary world because people love talking about sports here when they're done tired of talking about politics. I am still a big fan of college athletics, and I think it can be really helpful, but also destructive in a lot of ways. And I just hope that, I don't know, it would be nice if we came back to some standard of strength again, but without all the bullshit that's happened.
But can you have that? I mean, can you have a good team without everything else at this point, without spending that kind of money on a program? I mean, I don't know if you saw this in the news recently, but the University of Alabama at Birmingham just decided to close their football program. It's the first major closure, I think, quite a few decades. And other schools are also looking at this. And, Michigan isn't the only school where student attendance is down. Student attendance at a lot of games is down.
Right.
And then you have all these schools saying we're not turning a profit anymore. These programs are costing us so much money. Well, what are you spending the money on? There are expenses. So I think a lot of colleges are having to sort of take a long introspective look and think about what these programs mean to them, what it means to them to be competitive at a certain level in football and basketball especially, but all sports. And what kind of decisions they want to make going forward, Michigan, more so than anyone.
You're not gonna. You look like you're almost gonna offend me, like by saying something about Michigan. Don't go right ahead.
Oh, no, I have no issues. Like I said, my dad was a fan growing up. They're not Notre Dame, but that's a whole
Right,
other.
we're not Notre Dame. Let's be clear on that. Yeah, I don't. Honestly, I kind of think it's kind of a good idea. I kind of feel terrible saying that, but I kind of think for a lot of programs, it's just kind of a waste. And even at Michigan, the new president, Schlissel, I think I said his name wrong.
I think you did. I think so.
He has said he comes from this really, he comes from Brown and Berkeley, and you feel sorry for the guy because he was thrown into this big football culture. But he's like his big campaign thing or his big promise has been student affordability. And, like every traditionally great program, Michigan's football program gets a huge amount of money. Like an
Right.
insane amount of money and influence.
A lot from private donors.
Right. And right. And so private donors write the check and they don't say, here's the money, do what you want. They say, I want this to go to the football program and I want to be able to point to my friends in the skybox and say, that was me. Who cares about, the importance of the lit department or something?
Yeah, I think then that's the question is, are these programs coming at the expense of other, if they're privately funded or whatnot, how much do they impact the rest of school and how much do they benefit the rest of school? How much do students really want this? I think, there is a strong appetite still for college football at a lot of schools. And the question is kind of be evaluating how good does that football have to be? How strong do these? And I think Michigan is a good example of a school where, you know what, if it's not that good, attendance is going to go down. Enthusiasm is going to go down. So what does that mean going forward?
It sounds like, Mina, it sounds like you're really asking how far is Michigan going to suck before it either gets better or they get rid of the program? I think it's going to be a long time because I think Michigan is the most conservative of conservative schools in terms of keeping its football program. It's dark now and everybody's been assuming that, this is the darkest of it, but it could get, you're right. It could last a while. I don't really know. So I want to move on to a different topic, and you just happen to be my guest for this one. I want to be very, very delicate on this one because it's on Rolling Stone's story about gang rape at the University of Virginia. And when this came out, this story got a lot of attention, and it was a very in-depth piece on gang rape there. And there was a lot. Rolling Stone quickly published a follow-up of other commenters and letters written in saying, this is definitely true, victims saying, I know someone or a result of gang rape or something in their Greek system there. I'm sorry, because I really want to walk this fine line here. Recently, questions have arisen about the reporting and thoroughness of the original Rolling Stone story. The author, in an interview with the Washington Post, Farhi, I think his name is, and then in Slate, suggested repeatedly that she did not make every single effort to contact the alleged attackers of the primary victim that the piece was written around. Since then, there's been more and more coverage about whether this story was partially or fully a hoax in some perspective. Rolling Stone has been very careful about this and released a statement saying that we found the author's reporting to be very, very extensive and believable, and we stand by it. I don't want to touch on, what evidence there is or what evidence there is lacking. What I want to hit with you is one thing that I've found interesting, and one of our top editors at TPM, when I was talking with him about it, said that he predicted that over the next few days there would be a strong political divide, a hardening political divide between the right and the left on this story. And lo and behold, that's what happened. Conservative-leaning outlets have basically said, we're just asking questions, but, parts of this story look unbelievable or look like outright bullshit. And liberal-leaning outlets have meanwhile said, you're asking questions without much proof that these are completely wrong. Your motivation is flimsy on this. This is destructive because it discourages victims from coming forward on rape and reporting rape. I just want to ponder this with you. I want to throw out a theory about why this is happening, which is Rolling Stone is one of the most infamous established countercultural magazines out there. And naturally, the conservative movement is disinclined to follow the counterculture movement. But I want to laud National Review for writing a critical piece of one of the earliest sort of critics of the Rolling Stone story, and I thought that was really good, and I'll make sure that's in the links at the end. What do you think, Mina?
Yeah, I haven't read the National Review piece, but I've read the other stuff you mentioned, and yeah, I guess without getting into sort of the veracity of the actual content of the piece, which they've said they fact-checked. To me, sort of as a, not as a journalist, but as a reader, learning this additional information that she didn't contact the people. And I guess I had read, you know, the Times did a story on this, and they quoted a couple of journalism professors, and I was kind of struck by their comments. One said, "Well, if this was a first-person account, it'd be fine." And I was like, "Yeah, you're right. You know, if this Jackie was the name of the, if she had written something, she wouldn't have had to." But the problem with that for me is that it wasn't a first-person account. It was presented as a third-person account. And I do feel that as a reader, when I read something that's a narrative or a third person, there are a certain set of expectations baked into it to where I was surprised to learn this and felt like, well, you know, I had read some pieces about how with in cases of sexual assault, there's the victims often don't want you to contact, you know, the people they're accusing for reasons that are quite legitimate that I respect. So I wish. To me now, as a reader, you know, I kind of feel like that should have been written into the piece, right? I mean, then I none of this would be confusing, or I mean, you could take issue with that conceptually, but I think this is a matter of just expectations and sort of what was actually delivered.
One can really, I mean, because I think if, I mean, the story was written over, I can't remember if the alleged attackers had graduated by the time the incident con
They hadn't. Maybe
Yeah,
not
I
that.
mean, so one, and one thing I even reading the piece, I did feel is like, you know, in reaching out, could you have put the victim Jackie in physical danger again?
Right. So say, right? I mean, write that into. I didn't reach
And I
out
think right, but
to
I don't
them
feel as unless I was a reporter like I am that that would have really come into my, you know, consideration where you're thinking about how much you can say, because one of the cardinal rules that we go by is that you're like one of the biggest rules in national security reporting is that you don't report, or you go to your source and you don't report, you check, I'm going to report this. Is there a reason? Could this put American troops in danger? And they are in their right. And I think a lot of the times there are instances where news outlets hold back on reporting because they are given enough proof that this could endanger. And that's sort of the same thing here.
back on reporting altogether. This is the reporting came out. She just didn't do, you know, and I think, you know, when I'm talking about my expectations as a reader with a narrative piece, are those maybe different because I'm a journalist? I don't know. I'd love to hear from other people. Did they, were they like, oh, I totally am surprised to hear that she didn't do this. I expected this because of the way it was presented as a narrative. I don't know. I'm just speaking to my own.
I wanted to ask you, I thought this was a really good perspective, and I'm really glad, you know, because I'm sweating over like handling this at all. I want to ask you about one other comment in the New York Times piece. Another journalism professor at Columbia, I want to say.
Mugging.
What?
Sorry. The guy who said if it wasn't mugging,
Yeah, the mugging one. So like I thought that was a really interesting point. So he said, you know, in the case when we report when there are reports on a mugging, you don't go and chase the mugger or try and find the mugger there, which kind of it struck me as kind of like it, in some ways a good point, but not a good point because in a mugging, you can't find this person.
Well, also, okay, if you're writing about a mugging, person's reported to the police, there's this extra layer of evidence, right, that maybe doesn't require to. And secondly, if you're writing about a mugging or some other crime and that was the centerpiece of the story, and it was unproven, it had been unreported, and you know it mattered, you probably, or any kind of crime, you would try to find the perpetrator, right, if this was sort of the narrative. So and I don't think that analogy quite holds for me.
I think I'm kind of with you on that. At first, I thought that was kind of a good one, but I'm with you. You won me over on that one. My God, Mina, this podcast is pretty, you know, pretty grim. Woodruff and Strauss is usually not this bad. I want to move to the next cheerful topic, which just broke a little while ago, which is that TNR has, oh, so. We're going to end on a light note. I need you to think about
Sure, yeah.
something to talk about at the end in the last 5 minutes that is cheerful. But
Okay.
before we get there, news just broke a little while ago that the New Republic, Franklin Foer, an institution on there, and Leon Wieseltier, who is a legend in political journalism, period, are leaving the New Republic and being repl and the magazine will be sort of rejiggered again, and run by Gabriel Snyder, formerly of Bloomberg News, and he edited The Wire at The Atlantic, which I'm a big fan of, by the way. But that's kind of my particular specialty in journalism, which is fast breaking news and quick hits. Shit, man. It's never fun
Really
to
upset, yeah. A lot of
like
feels.
I don't really know. I mean, you just sort of it's never so the rumor that I've heard is that they want to make it more integral to the internet and kind of like BuzzFeed again. I'm always skeptical when publications say we want to be the X of Y. I don't know about you because
I'm the Uber of sports writers, so I'm.
okay, yeah.
Speak for yourself.
The lift of politics journalism or something like that.
Oh, sorry, my dogs.
That's okay. Maybe we can talk about dogs to finish this out or something. Oh, who is that?
Hey.
Oh, that
Fans about the New Republic.
is
Okay.
what
Yeah, well, I guess, we're in a moment where Vox just raised several hundred million dollars or something crazy, and BuzzFeed's increasingly. So, with these publications, it's just, do they want to be a business, or are they more like, a sort of nonprofit, really? I mean,
By the way, it was a little surprising to me that Vox, raised all this money because, like, I mean, the thing is, I don't know about in New York or sports journalism where you are, but like, there's kind of like a new kid on the block always gets, bullied a little bit. Like, everyone scoffed at Politico for a long time. Now they run the table with political reporting. They're
sure.
like, they own it. And I sort of predicted that with Vox. Everyone was like, Vox is not good and stuff. And the rumor was their traffic was down and not were hitting the targets that they wanted to. But I mean, they're going to be here for a while, I guess.
Yeah.
What is the? I mean, what do you think of that? What is there any observation from where you are on this? On I guess sports outlets or just that stuff in
Well,
general?
there are equivalents in sports as well, startups. I mean, the Bleacher Report kind of came out of nowhere. Huge espionage. I mean, there are always new things, right? Or when I was in business, Quartz started. I mean, journalism is so funny because there's this kind of simultaneous sort of scent of death and constant birth going on all around us, and nobody really knows what to make of it, right? So I don't, I mentioned this to you earlier. I don't have emotional attachment to the New Republic, and it seems like a lot of people do. So I almost feel guilty talking about it. But it does seem like, as I was saying earlier, they were confronted. They chose to ask this question: do we want to be a business? Or,
The
and by
noble.
business, I mean the kind of business that wants to grow some trade and raise a lot of money and that kind of thing. And that apparently is what they're interested in. I think for people who are interested in a certain kind of journalism, that is sad.
Yeah. I just I remember a little while ago I was looking through the Oxford American, and which is a great publication. Yeah, I'm weird. All right, I'm just making that judge face. But like you just sort of there are some great publications that just fit an era like that and are not gonna thrive in the same way that other ones like that would have.
Thriving, I mean, a lot of publications are perfectly content with just coming out every month and staying above water and paying for great journalism and not growing. Why? I mean, and not to get, anti-capitalist on you, but there. Why does the journalism have to be? Why does a publication have to be a growth machine?
Because money, Mina, because we want to, I mean, I think, I feel like a lot of, I feel like a lot of, there is this sort of desire among, actually, I don't know, but like there was an era where, you could do the Don Draper of the journalism thing and you could like the three martini lunch, the big piece and the celebrity about that. But
Well,
yeah.
anyway, hey, we were talking about Fox and BuzzFeed. They're hiring people like crazy, and that's a
Yeah.
good thing, right? So, I don't know. I don't like it when people are just kind of scolds about what they're doing and the work that we actually, I think they're doing really good work, but I don't know what the New Republic's going to look like under the new regime, but I don't think anyone does.
I think you have a slightly more optimistic sort of view of the whole environment, or a Zen view about all of this, which is good, which is,
Well, I just feel like kind of the constant hand-wringing is a little exhausting.
Yeah, that sounds. I'm a warrior, so like, yeah. Let's finish out. You've just inspired me. Let's finish out with 1 or 2 minutes talking about dogs in New York, because I'm a big dogs fan. How do you raise a dog in New York? Are
Well,
you just
I work at home.
okay? But
That's.
I mean, you know, every time I visit the city, like, do your dogs only know like the cage dog parks or like in city streets or like.
Yeah, well, there's dog parks and then, bigger parks if you live near one. I live near McCarran Park in Brooklyn. But
Oh, well.
I think if you don't work at home, I don't know how people do. I mean, they have dog walkers, but I think it's a lot more difficult. So when I switched to ESPN in the spring from my previous job, I was at Bloomberg before that Fortune, and I started working from home, and I immediately knew that, that finally my time to get a dog
Yeah.
come, because I'm with him all day
Yeah. So
for
I
a little
guess
few months.
you need to be with them and, you
You
know.
still there?
Yeah,
Uh-oh.
I'm still with you. Yeah, we're breaking up a little
Oh,
bit,
okay.
but show
There you
must
go.
go on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I guess
Yeah,
and
but it is a lot of
is
work.
your dog a mutt? What's
He
the theory on what he is? I'm a mutt fan.
is a mutt. I adopted him from a shelter. He's, they think, a Chihuahua beagle, a teagle.
A
He's about three.
Chihuahua beagle, so
Here, I'll
he.
give you a closer look.
Okay,
Ah.
Mina's bringing this poor animal up for all the blogging heads viewers to see. Okay,
Can you get
he's staring right at the camera. He looks slightly intrigued, a little freaked out. Okay. Well, he seems nice. So there is, I guess, the conclusion we can. It is possible to own a dog, to have a happy dog in New York. I guess we can end on that, conclude that one.